Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Carrie Turcotte, the coordinator of Asset. What is it, Carrie? Come on.
Asset Development Initiatives.
Asset Development Initiatives, of course, at the Welcome Inn in North End, Hamilton. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You have a program that might help people who see some of their benefits disappearing with the clawback of the special diet program, and people who have ambitions to put together a little seed capital for whatever reason on a disability or a workfare income, or you would even work with low-paid private employed people, wouldn't you?
I will. This particular version of the program is called Savings Hamilton, and it's a scaled-back version of the Matched Savings Program we started 2 years ago. But it's funded specifically as a pilot project by the Hamilton Community Foundation so that we can work with people who we would qualify as very low income earners, which just happens to nicely fit the income range of people receiving Ontario Works benefits or ODSP benefits or a frightening number of the working poor as well. So people whose single household member income would be under $19,000 a year would qualify for the program.
So this would probably include a lot of part-time employees at places like Walmart and so forth.
Absolutely, absolutely. A whole lot of people earning minimum wage, even full-time, would come very close to qualifying. If they have more than one person in their household, they would definitely fall within the income cutoff. So.
Oh, okay. All right. What can you tell these people about the benefits of taking part in this program?
There are a couple, actually. I mean, from my perspective as a program manager, there is the opportunity to have conversations about money, which is something that people don't do nearly often enough. We'll talk about all sorts of crazy things in public forums, but we don't want to talk about money. That's really difficult for people. And I think especially when you're operating with really limited options in terms of how you spend your money. And that can be people who are living with very limited incomes, but it can also be people who live with higher income levels where their debt load is very, very high. So there's not a lot of discretionary cash at the end of the pay period. It's about what's left over that you can make choices about, because programmatically we want to do financial literacy education. We want to talk about money management. We want to have a financial literacy learning opportunity. So we talk about budgeting. We talk about credit, how credit works and how to use it as a tool as opposed to as something to bludgeon yourself with. We talk about debt, so how to deal with that in ways that are less panic-inducing, perhaps, than some of the strategies that folks employ. We're working on a cool identity theft workshop that I'm really excited about. But the really important thing, I think, is that it creates an opportunity to make an actual choice about how to spend money. So people come into the program, they save what they can afford to save once a month for 6 months. And at the end of the 6 months, we provide a check for the matching funds. And those funds.
There's a ceiling on this, though.
There is. There's a maximum of $40 a month that we can match. The funding for the program limits us quite a bit. But so far, that seems to be a comfortable range for people. So if somebody wants to save $100 a month, they could still participate in the program, but I could still only match $40 a month. But at the end of 6 months, I mean, there's the potential to have $240 in completely discretionary income. Mm-hmm. It's money that Welcome In will share with somebody so that they can then turn around and really put into practice some of those principles that we'll talk about over the course of the program. We talk about how you make decisions about money, but if there's no decision to be made, you know, if all you can do is buy food and pay rent, and then there's nothing left, you're not making choices. Those aren't options. So what this program does is give people an opportunity to sort of explore their relationship with money, but then to actually make some choices with some cash to buy something that, you know, improves their existence in whatever way they define that.
But you mentioned there's the chance to have $240 at the end of 6 months. But in fact, there's the chance to receive a gift of $240 at
That's
the
right.
end of 6 months. So you'll have $480.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, you know, it's not a huge amount of money, but people are intending to do all sorts of things. Some people are intending to, buy summer clothes for their kids. Some people are intending to buy a new TV or a new couch or go on a trip. And, you know, it's all about making the choice. It's about having the opportunity to say, you know, I choose to spend this money in this way. And there's nobody saying, well, why are you making that choice? And nobody questioning your right to make that choice. And I think that that's really critical, especially for people living with very tight budgets and on fixed incomes, because often that's the first thing that people think that they have the right to do is say, well, why are you spending that? And so we're trying to create a safe space to make choices.
And apparently ODSB and Ontario Works have agreed to go along that there's no question about what happens to this money.
Yep. Actually, 3 years ago, when we were first talking with the powers that be about how to treat this income or how to treat this money, there was the question of whether it was income or not, and they were quite happy to not consider it income.
Really?
And recently, I spoke with some folks at ODSP because they had some additional questions about how to handle it, and it seems that we are still good to go ahead and consider it as not income. So people are okay to participate in the program, which is great because it's not income. It's a gift and shouldn't be clawed back. So, although I challenged them that perhaps it would be a nice strategy to consider it income, because then I would, you know, match it monthly and people would get the $100 for earning income as well as the matching funds. And they didn't think that was as good an idea. So I think that they'll leave the money alone.
I see. Very good. Okay. Leverage appears. I wanted to ask about this $19,000 limit on qualifying income. What does that mean? Is that after taxes?
Actually, the income caps are gross. They're pre-tax incomes. What they work out to be is 90% of the low-income cutoff. So it's just over $19,000 for a single person. Mm-hmm. And then as your household size goes up, the income cap increases as well. So if you're a single parent with a couple of children, your income cap is sort of in the mid-20s. And so it depends entirely on household size, but I would invite people to just give me a call, because we don't have a lot of flexibility in the income cap. We have much more wiggle room in the geographic requirements.
But, okay.
So far, I mean, anybody who's receiving OW or ODSP will be under the income cap. There is no question. Mm-hmm. And anybody, if you're making $10 an hour working 40 hours a week, if you have one other person in your household, you're under the income cap.
Okay.
So there's a whole very large group of people that are potentially eligible for this program. And we have 40 spaces in total for this pilot phase of the program, of which I have about 15 left. So
okay.
I'm eager to talk to people. I'm taking applications through January and probably into mid-February. So.
Right. But you mentioned to me that some people will start into the program at the end of January, probably.
Yep, I will keep taking applications until I've filled the spaces. So
there'll be no match saving until you filled all the spaces?
No, actually, I had a group of people who started in December. I had about 12 people who started in December, so they will finish the program as of the end of May. I have a group of people who are sort of rolling already in January, and they'll finish at the end of June. So anybody who's able to start the program by the end of January will finish at the end of June. And then anybody I bring in February will finish in July. So.
Well, the last installment of the special diet for people who no longer qualify will be July 31st. So people should keep that in mind if you want a little cushion in the bank if that happens and when it happens.
Well, and if it doesn't happen, then you still have a little cushion in the bank, and that
exactly.
can't be a bad thing.
No. Okay.
Now, this program ran once before. Can you tell us about the success of the program before?
Sure. Actually, the original version of the Match Savings Program, which is called Savings Plan, was simultaneously very successful and not very successful. In terms of financial literacy education, it was quite successful. We got to have lots of great conversations with program participants. What we found was that recruiting people for the program was next to impossible. And I think that it was because of a basic lack of familiarity with how programs like this work. In places like British Columbia and Manitoba, match savings programs have a fairly... People are fairly aware of them, whereas in Ontario, because we're 15 years behind right. all of the sort of cutting-edge community economic development work that happens in other places in Canada, it's much lower profile and people are somewhat distrustful. And I had several conversations with people who were inquiring about the program that made me think that they were absolutely convinced that it was a scam.
Really?
Yeah, it was wild. And I have had some people come through. I've had two people graduate from the program in the last year or so who were saving toward the small business asset goal, mm-hmm. which was really exciting because both saved very close to the maximum program amount, which was $1,500 in savings. And so I was able to match that with an additional $3,000 for one and another almost $2,000, I believe, for another. So it's
in the old program.
Yeah, totally different scale, much more difficult program to get people into because it's a much longer savings period. So it's between 12 and 36 months, depending on the asset goals. And it's very limited in terms of asset goals. You're either saving for education or small business startup or the down payment on a house. And there's no deviation from those. And so that the nice thing about the newer version of the program, while it's smaller amounts, is it's a much shorter time frame. So people are seeing the results of their work mm-hmm. more quickly, and there's no evaluation sort of on our part organizationally of, you know, is this the correct asset goal? Like we're not asking those questions. Instead, the goal is only to create the choice. Okay. And once that's accomplished, that's a successful outcome. And so everybody is sort of aiming toward that as opposed to evaluating, you know, what the money gets spent on in the end, which I think is really important in terms of asset development more generally. I think people have to have those choices.
Yeah. Mid-interview, let's take a break with a very talented group, Steel Rail, and an instrumental by Dave Clark called Catherine. appears that the Hamilton Community Foundation sees it as presenting the opportunity for choice to people who wouldn't otherwise have it.
Absolutely. And I think that it's a piece that's lacking from sort of the logic of programs like ODSP and OW is the understanding that people, all people, need some agency and some self-determination. And when you take away that at a financial level, it has repercussions throughout every other area of their lives. And so I think this is very much like the...
Yeah, if you don't give them legitimate choices, they'll make illegitimate choices.
Well, and it's very much in keeping with the asset development philosophy that sort of underlines our programming, especially the financial literacy programming and then the business development programming, in that the money piece, right, financial assets, is only one small part of what you really want to build with people. I mean, we want to build social assets so people are connected to each other and to places like Welcome In, and build skills assets so that people can make good decisions about credit because they have good information about how it works. Within themselves, personal assets in terms of having confidence when talking to a creditor or a potential creditor, and knowing that you have certain rights and being confident enough to, put that forward, and dealing with money and the whole sort of psychodrama around money in a way that is more constructive and saner, because it's awful to watch how traumatized people can become. And people who are very educated and very otherwise well put together, and the crazy decisions they make about money because it terrifies them. And so it's...
Really?
Yep, it's unbelievable. I know people who have had to declare bankruptcy because they won't return a simple phone call. And they've lost the ability to leverage assets like interest relief on student loans because they're terrified to make the call. And it's so important to have those conversations with people and to have people understand that money isn't a big mystery. It should be a tool. It should be something that you control.
Well, it quickly deteriorates into an adversarial fulcrum, money, too, where you get people calling you up and saying, my name is Mr. Payne, and you have to deal with me. And no, you don't have a choice. You have to deal the way I say.
Exactly.
And you're teaching people that they do have a choice.
Absolutely. And that choice is the critical piece. If you want to get on top of money at whatever income level, you have to acknowledge that you're making choices. And then you have to be very conscious of the choices that you're making. And then you can make whatever choices you want or need to make.
Well, but, and the thing about money is that they often preclude other choices in that time frame, too.
Yep.
Which is something I think people have a hard time with.
Well, and I think it really helps people to have the opportunities to talk about money and understand that other people have the same challenges. Because I think that for me has been one of the most interesting pieces of all of this, is understanding that even people who have it all together, financially, and they get money, they understand how to make it work for them. Mm-hmm. They didn't always know those things, or they didn't always have those skills, or they didn't always have that confidence about dealing with money. And sometimes it's fairly hard won, but it's possible.
Yeah.
It's like most things. It's a learned piece of how we live. And it needs to be something that people feel that they can control. Because if you feel like it controls you, it's terrifying and traumatic. And that's
I see. Yeah. So you have a couple of workshops that go with this, at least one workshop.
Yep. We have three and hopefully a fourth one. We'll do budgeting workshops. And we talk all the way through about assets of different types. We'll do a credit workshop. We'll do a workshop on debt. And one of the things that I really like about the workshops is while they're full of good information, they're not full of a whole lot of pronouncements.
Okay.
They're workshops for real people dealing with real money, as opposed to people sitting in front of the room saying, thou shalt save money and thou shalt pay off debt. We talk about how. Mm-hmm. How to make those choices, given the circumstances of the people in the room, how to make those choices. Mm. And how to make them in ways that are realistic and fit with people's actual lives, because it's all lovely to make a budget, but how do you live with your budget? And so working on those kinds of issues, because, again, you know, part of the challenge is talking about money. Part of the challenge is talking about money in ways that reflect reality. Because we all know that, you know, we are supposed to save and we're supposed to do all of these things around money, but, you know, far fewer people do that or do it well. And so, you know, obviously the lessons don't work, you know, as pronouncements. So we need to talk about how to make a budget that works. You know, if you need to include a line in your budget, as I do, for, you know, random things that I buy on the spur of the moment,
okay,
I do it. Because I know when I've budgeted too tightly. I always tell people in budgeting workshops, I know when I've budgeted too restrictively because I suddenly start to crave McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I suddenly start to crave cheeseburgers. And, you know, normally that's not an issue. But as soon as I feel like I don't have choices to make about money, I start craving fast food.
Oh.
And it becomes this overwhelming compulsion to buy fast food because I'm making a choice. I have to eat. So there's a justification.
I think that's what Tim Hortons is about.
Yep.
Timbits, you know, the 3-cent choice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that, you know, being aware of the fact that I do that makes all the difference in the world, because now I can just say, oh, I need to go back and look at my budget, because that's really what the issue is. It's got nothing to do with cheeseburgers. But, you know, it took me years to figure that out. And yeah. I ate an awful lot of cheeseburgers before I figured that out.
Well, that's great. that's impressive.
Yeah.
So I remember being in a talking to someone about finances before my mother's death, who took a look at my financial situation and said, you know, you really need to put an awful lot of money into an RRSP at your age. And I just looked at him like, you know, yeah, and I need a Lincoln Continental and a yacht and a private plane. You know, what are you going to do about it?
Yep.
I think you're right. I don't think conventional financial counseling, you know, has anything to say to these people who are attending your workshop and taking advantage of your plan. They have different problems, or problems of different degree, that preclude easy answers and easy solutions.
Well, for sure. And I think, too, that our lives are too full of the word should. You should do this. Well, no kidding. I should save. I should spend less. I should eat my vegetables. But the way that I actually live is that when I feel like I don't have any money, I buy cheeseburgers. There are no vegetables in cheeseburgers at all. But that's how those decisions get made. And if we don't meet people where they're at,
yeah,
how then can anyone be surprised? Yeah, how can you be surprised when, you know, me, I could stand in front of a room full of people and say, yes, make a budget, make a budget. But if we don't talk about how that might actually look or how it might actually work.
Or benefit you.
Yeah, like why do I need to? I mean, I can do basic math. I make this much money, take off how much I spend. Look at that, I have less than zero. Whoops. You know, great, so now what? You know, and how do I deal with that? And how do I deal with the stress of that?
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that still makes me feel like a human being at the end of the month, because, you know, especially when you're living, you know, at lower income levels, and especially when that income is coming from, you know, various and assorted government agencies, there's enough oversight. There's enough, you should do this, or you have to do this. You know, what we need to talk about is how we live as people.
Yeah, you know? The famous line that I recall is somebody told me their worker saw them in Tim Hortons buying a coffee and said, how come you're in here buying a coffee? You're on benefits, right?
Wow.
Yeah.
But not really surprising, because there is so much of that. You know, why are you accessing a food bank? You drove a car to get here.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I'm accessing a food bank because I need food.
Yeah.
What does one have to do with the other? Nothing, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing. But there's so much of that. There's so, and that's ultimately what, you know, what the whole asset development piece is about, is taking that and then talking about what's really going on, you know,
yeah.
and talking about, okay, so if that makes your budget work, if visiting a couple of food banks in a 30-day period makes your budget work, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
You would be crazy not to, because how much stress can you alleviate, you
know, yeah,
by doing that? If you can do that in a way that feels comfortable and sane, okay.
Yeah.
That's why they're there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's... Mm-hmm. It's really, we need to have these conversations, because they're all part of the whole constellation of choices that surround money.
So,
the Match Savings Program is great because it has the perk of offering some sort of free unencumbered cash. But, I mean, it's a lot of hard work. You know, I don't want anybody to think that it's sort of a six-month cakewalk, because it's challenging. If you really sit down and you really think about your relationship with money, it's challenging. But it can also be, you know, pretty life-altering to sit down and get good with money. I mean, you know, because $240, you know, in matching dollars isn't going to solve anybody's, you know, giant financial crisis.
Yeah.
But the feeling of empowerment that comes from developing some assets like skills around money and, you know, the ability to communicate about money without having a breakdown, you know, connections to other people who are dealing with similar issues, that kind of stuff, that sticks with you, that that only increases in value over time. So I think it's a really valuable opportunity for people, and I really, really hope that you know, people will take me up on my last 15 spots, because it's so far been a really interesting experience to work with the folks that started in December. So
how do they get in touch with you?
They should either call Welcome In Community Center, which is 905-525-5824, and they can ask for me. My name is Carrie. Or they can email me, and my email is EconDev, which is short for economic development. So it's ECONDEV, like Victor, at WelcomeIn, which is welcome.ca. The easiest way is to just give me a call. So it's 905-525-5824.
There you go. Okay. And take me out to lunch when you get your $240 in matching funds.
No cheeseburgers.
Thanks, Carrie.
Thank you.
It's Dalton McGuinty. At least my handlers say it is. And if you'll vote for me in 2011, I have a promise for you. But seriously, a question. Have you yet applied for your Ontario government fishing or hunting license? Right here in Hamilton, for some of the best wetlands in Canada, the Red Hill Valley. Anybody? And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the articles from the papers that we read to you. These are abridgments or condensations of the articles from the papers that we announce in the broadcast. Leading off the review of the news, a fresh, if undated, announcement from the King of Kitsch, and signed by Sandra Dutters-Beer, Regional Director for the Director of the Ontario Disability Support Program. These people need a lot of direction. I'm writing to tell you about changes to the Special Diet Allowance coming in April 2011. The changes to the Special Diet Allowance will make the program more accountable and comply with the Human Rights Tribunal of Ontario decision. Here are key changes being made. The list of eligible medical conditions will be revised. Some medical conditions will no longer be eligible for a special diet allowance. This means some people will stop getting an allowance. If you have an eligible medical condition, you will need to submit a new application form to be considered for the revised special diet allowance. We will send you the new application form in February 2011. People who do not submit a new application form for an eligible medical condition will stop receiving the special diet allowance by July 31, 2011. Stronger tracking methods will help make sure people receiving the allowance are eligible for it. Please see the back of this letter for a proposed list of medical conditions eligible for the revised special diet allowance and for more information on what these changes mean to you. If you'd like to talk to someone about this letter, please call your local office or the Service Ontario info line toll-free at 1-888-789-4199. Now, I'm going to give you that number again because that is also the number where you can find the number to opt out of eHealth, where they keep the information you'll be required to sign over to ODSP. 1-888-789-4199. And now for the news items that matter to you, whether or not you're on the special diet. Officer charged in G20 assault case. After nearly 6 months, several videos and a showdown between Toronto's police chief and a provincial watchdog that played out in front of the national media, an officer has been charged with beating a man during the G20 demonstrations. Out of 16 officers identified as possibly being in the area during the arrest of Adam Nobody at Queen's Park, only one provided the agency with the information it required to lay a charge, prompting fresh questions from the injured man. What I still don't understand is how 12 police officers who were around me when I was arrested aren't able to identify anyone. I hope that something can still be done about this. Police identified 16 officers believed to have knowledge of the incident, provided their names to the SIU, which classified three of them as suspects and others as witnesses. One of them, a Toronto officer, pointed to Constable Andalib Gurtani. The others could not identify anyone allegedly responsible, the SIU said. The defense points out that Constable Andalib Gurtani arrived carrying a shotgun and told one of his colleagues to detain and handcuff an elderly black man carrying a stick that had no apparent connection to the incident, the judge wrote. Critics, who questioned why it took a media firestorm for the SIU to get the evidence it needed, suggested the agency could have done a better job of soliciting videos and photographs from the public earlier in the investigation or pressing police harder to help identify officers. It took an awful lot to get SIU Director Ian Scott to lay a charge here, said lawyer Peter Rosenthal, who's dealt with SIU-related cases in the past. I think the SIU in general has to be more vigorous in their investigations. That by Adrian Morrow in Wednesday, December 22nd's Globe and Mail. And this from Spectator News Services. Flu cases higher while fewer had shot. Ontario has reported 1,075 positive tests for the seasonal flu so far, compared with fewer than 400 at this point during a normal flu season, according to public health officials. But fewer Ontarians have received the flu shot. The flu has hit earlier this year, with numbers not usually seen until later in the winter, and what has got officials worried is that fewer got the flu shot. Figures aren't in yet, but it appears only 24% of people have received a flu shot, compared with 35% in normal years and 45% during last year's pandemic. After some jolts to their electricity bills from rising prices, the new HST, and a hot summer of air conditioning, Ontario consumers will notice a nice surprise as 2011 begins. It's a 10% break on their hydro costs, which was announced in November and takes effect New Year's Day for homes, farms, and small businesses. Energy Minister Brad Duguid has warned electricity prices are expected to double over the next 20 years, rising 3.5% a year annually, even with the 10% discount. Critics say consumers might not be getting the discount had polls not revealed Premier Dalton McGuinty's Liberals trailing Tim Hudak's Progressive Conservatives in the polls throughout the fall. People are feeling this government has done very little for them as they struggle to emerge from the recession, said New Democrat leader Andrea Horvath. The electricity discount is one of several changes. Others include new consumer protection for natural gas and electricity contracts. The rules now require price comparisons between the contract being offered and prices from a consumer's existing supplier, curbing what Duguid calls shady sales practices. Programs like the Ontario Energy and Property Tax Credit will offer seniors who own or rent their homes up to $1,025 in relief. Two-thirds of seniors will receive some assistance. The last of three checks to help Ontarians adjust to the new 13% harmonized sales tax comes in June, $100 for singles. A reduction in time-of-use electricity rates coming in May, when the evening period of highest cost rates will end earlier at 7 p.m. This will apply to the growing list of 1 million Ontarians on time-of-use smart meters measuring their power usage. Opposition parties are wondering why the Liberals are waiting until May to lower prime-time hydro rates for customers on time-of-use smart meters, which price your power depending on the time of day and season. Opposition parties also say the price break, 10%, barely makes up for the fact that electricity bills also went up this year when the new 13% harmonized sales tax came into effect July 1st. adding in the 8% provincial portion of HST to hydro bills. Government officials say it made the most sense to wait and make the change May 1st when new summer power use schedules came into effect. They also note it will be cheaper to cool down houses and apartments when people get home from work in the evenings if Ontario has another hot summer. And when will those electricity bills arrive? Likely during the election campaign, which will begin in earnest after Labor Day. That from the Toronto Star, Rob Ferguson in the Queen's Park Bureau. Math glitch to blame, taxpayers group says. Ontarians will feel the biggest pinch. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation says the inflation rate in Ontario, which was higher than the national average last year, leads to higher personal income taxes. An Ontarian earning $45,000 a year will end up paying an extra $390 in income and payroll taxes in 2011, it says. The reason for the hike is a mathematical glitch, explained Derek Fildebrand, research director with the Taxpayers Federation in Ottawa. Increases to EI and the pension plans have been in the works for some time, but the income tax hikes are coming because of higher inflation rates, he said. To calculate the indexing of tax rates, Ottawa uses a two-year rolling national average for inflation. Workers often receive wage increases based on local inflation rates, which vary from province to province. Fildebrand says this year's inflation was about 1 point higher than in 2009. That means Canadians who got a cost of living adjustment this past year will be bumped into a higher tax bracket. Chisholm Potier, spokesman for Finance Minister Jim Flaherty, disputed the taxpayers' group's findings. Income tax rates are not going up, and the thresholds at which an individual's income begins to be subject to tax or becomes subject to a higher tax rate all remain indexed to inflation, he said. Other changes announced by the federal government include a 1.7% boost in CPP benefits and a 0.5% increase in old age security. The major change this year is on the corporate side, where the business tax rate falls from 18% to 16.5%. It's due to fall to 15% in 2012. The corporate tax cut amounts to a $1.65 billion gift to firms in 2011, an issue likely to be hotly debated in the next election campaign. Liberal MP and government services critic Jeff Reagan said the Conservatives should put the tax cut on hold and use the money to reduce the deficit and provide relief for the public. That from the Star, Saturday, January 1st, Alan Woods in the Ottawa Bureau. Let's take a break. Again with Steel Rail, 1,000 miles of snow.
Snow needles in the headlights, cold moon knows the way I feel. It was snowing in Toronto when I got behind the wheel, and 12 hours on the road. Now the flakes still coming down, 3 more days of blacktop till I'm back in my hometown. I'm driving home, I'm driving home through 1,000 miles of snow. Drifts dancing across the highway, static on the radio. I'm in Walk That Lonesome Valley, so I don't feel so alone. I left a life behind when I went east so many years ago. Now this empty road will take me back to faces I won't know. I'm driving home, I'm driving home across 1,000 miles of snow. Wish each time these wipers are, they'd sweep a week away. And in the center of the city, still heard that west wind blow. Now this old sled sits and my regrets will take my heart back home. I'm driving home, I'm driving home, across a thousand miles of snow. Driving home, yes I'm driving home, across a thousand miles of snow.
NDP vows to scrap HST on energy. Plan saves family $220 on hydro heating bills. NDP leader Andrea Horvath says she would scrap the harmonized sales tax on energy bills if her party won the next provincial election. To bankroll the $350 million reduction in hydro, natural gas, and heating oil levies, the new Democrats would raise corporate taxes. Horvath said her policy would save a family with two children about $220 a year in hydro and heating costs. Finance Minister Dwight Duncan emphasized the Liberals have no plans to introduce further exemptions for the HST, which took effect last July with the melding of the PST and GST. While the New Democrats and the Liberals are sparring over policy differences, the Progressive Conservatives are playing their electoral cards close to their chests. Conservative sources say that's because they fear the Liberals might abscond with their best ideas. That from the Star, Friday, January 7th, Robert Benzie, the Queen's Park Bureau Chief. And in the realm of those best ideas, spending cuts a possibility, Hudak warns. With a provincial election scheduled October 6, Hudak charged that Ontarians could not afford another 4 years of Premier Dalton McGuinty's Liberals. This is the deepest hole the province has ever faced, he said, referring to the fact spending has increased by 70% since the Liberals took office in 2008, while the debt and deficit have also ballooned. You don't get out of that challenge immediately. It'll take important decisions. But Hudak did not say which ministries or programs such as health and education a Conservative administration would cut if elected. We would have a sunset review process for every agency, board, commission, and ministry program to make sure they're delivering value for the tax dollar, Hudak said. That also by Robert Benzie, Queen's Park Bureau Chief, in the Star, January 6th. Hudak told of possible Niagara scandal in 2001. The controversy over alleged impropriety at the Niagara Parks Commission is now reaching back almost a decade to when Ontario's Conservative government was in office and when the party's current leader, Tim Hudak, was the minister responsible for the agency. As a continuing management purge claimed the agency's top bureaucrat, John Kernahan, Globe and Mail sources confirmed that a letter in 2001 addressed to Mr. Hudak and eight others raised specific concerns about another Parks Commission executive. The executive, Joel Noden, remained at the commission until he was fired, days before the Globe reported on the $400,000 in travel and entertainment expenses he claimed in a three-year period. Mr. Hudak, who was Minister of Tourism when the letter was sent, says he doesn't recall anything about it. In addition to the departures of Mr. Kernahan and Mr. Noden, four members of the agency's appointed 12-member board were removed by Tourism Minister Michael Chan and replaced with senior civil servants. Mr. Chan also ordered new internal audits of executive expenses and procurements going back 3 years. In May, Mr. Chan appointed Faye Brooker, a governance and auditing consultant, as board chairwoman and gave her a mandate to update agency practices, overhaul its structure, and sharpen board governance. Three Conservative MPPs rose in the legislature to accuse Ms. Booker of awarding contracts to friends and raising her own pay, the very type of behavior she has been told to root out. Ms. Booker, who has actually cut commissioners' pay by halving the number of board meetings and restructuring them, said she was floored by the misinformation used to attack her credibility. To say it's just politics is just a weak excuse, Ms. Booker said in an interview after addressing each of the claims in detail. The Conservatives were in power for many years. Are they afraid of what's going to come out? Asked about his party's claims against Ms. Booker, Mr. Hudak said, "We stand behind what we said during question period today." Why won't the Premier call in the Auditor General to investigate allegations of wrongdoings at the Niagara Parks Commission? NDP leader Andrea Horvath said. Citing the Parks Commission's incredibly important mandate in six recent Globe reports on concerns about the agency, Ms. Horvath made a written request to Auditor General Jim McCarter to conclusively address these disturbing revelations, put the Niagara Parks Commission back on track, and restore public confidence in the organization. That and the Globe and Mail by Anthony Reinhardt, Friday, December 9th. Veterans' pension suit can go ahead, top court rules. Military mechanic Dennis Manuge filed suit on behalf of about 6,500 injured veterans, and it was certified by the federal court. Mr. Manuge of Porter's Lake, Nova Scotia, was injured in 2002 at Canadian Forces Base Petawawa. The government later decided to take back $10,000 of his disability pension after he left the military. Mr. Manuge filed suit and got federal court approval for a class action. But the government appealed and won a stay of proceedings. The Federal Court of Appeal rejected Mr. Manuge's class action, ruling he should have applied for judicial review of the pension clawback at the federal court instead of opening a full-fledged lawsuit. Wrong, said the Supreme Court. In my view, with respect, the discretion to grant a stay should not be exercised in this case, wrote Madam Justice Rosalie Abella. Previously, an investigation by the military ombudsman found the clawback profoundly unfair. This appeal is fundamentally about access to justice, Mr. Justice Ian Binney wrote on behalf of the court. People who claim to be injured by government action should have whatever redress the legal system permits through procedures that minimize unnecessary costs and complexity. The court's approach should be practical and pragmatic with that objective in mind. And that by Mike Blanchfield in the Globe and Mail in Ottawa. Why you should care about inequality. Who will keep Canada from becoming a callous, ever more inequitable nation? You could. Before you dismiss this policy as utopian or unaffordable, do a quick cost-benefit analysis. Unless you belong to the richest 20% of the population, whose family income starts at $120,000, you're either working longer and harder to preserve your standard of living or you're falling back. You're losing ground. Unless you're prepared to devote an ever-growing portion of your taxes to police, prisons, and homeless shelter, you have an interest in curbing the income polarization that is turning Canada into a nation of extremes. Unless you think it is coincidence that nations with a relatively equitable distribution of wealth, the Nordic countries, fared better in the 2008-2009 recession than those with largest disparities, the United States, Britain, Ireland, Spain, and Russia, you have a reason to worry about an unbridgeable gap between the executive class and everyone else. Every society in which a tiny elite has amassed a vastly disproportionate share of the wealth, from 16th century Spain to America in the 1920s, has lost its footing, leading to either a traumatic collapse or an attenuated decline. But what can you do to counteract the trend? You can share more of your income with those who desperately need help. If enough Canadians did it, nonprofit organizations would be able to withstand the cutbacks governments are making, and politicians would sense a shift in public priorities. You can talk to your friends and colleagues about living in a country that has returned to pre-Great Depression levels of inequality. You can email or write to your MP, provincial representative, or any party leader asking what she is doing or planning to do to narrow the gulf between rich and poor. Your concern will register. You can encourage any organization to which you belong, your church, your book club, your alumni association, your seniors group, to speak out about the disturbing bifurcation of Canadian society. You can get involved in the coming election, supporting candidates or working as an activist outside the political system. You can join a global network such as the Equality Trust. www.equalitytrust.org.uk and stand with others willing to challenge the omnipotence of market forces. There is another option, of course, hanging on fiercely to your shrinking piece of the national pie, but it will keep shrinking. That by Carol Gore in Friday, January 7th's Toronto Star. McGuinty hints fall vote will be his last. Flanked by his wife, Terry, with an I, on a couch in his Queen's Park office, McGuinty gave his clearest signal yet that the October 6th election will be his last. If you win in October, are you going to serve out 4 years? Asked CTV's Paul Bliss. Normally, McGuinty, who was elected Premier in 2003 and has been an MPP since 1990, responds to such questions with assurances that he plans to remain in office until at least 2015. Under Bliss's grilling, however, the Premier 55 changed his tune. I'm not going to speculate as to how long, said McGuinty. A beatific smile suddenly splashed across his face. During the interview, it was clear that the McGuintys, who have 4 grown children, are looking forward to being able to spend more time together. Terry, who teaches kindergarten at a Toronto Catholic school, insisted the Premier hasn't changed much since being elected. Just grey hair, I think, and he's a little more, I wouldn't say romantic, but sensitive. He'll talk about his feelings more, which is really nice, she said. A slew of ministers and MPPs are quietly vying to succeed him as Liberal leader, a job he's held since 1996. Attorney General Chris Bentley is viewed as the front runner, but Health Minister Deb Matthews, Environment Minister John Wilkinson, and Transportation Minister Kathleen Wynne are all touted as possible chiefs. Several junior ministers and MPPs are also known to be interested. Again, Robert Benzie, Queen's Park Bureau Chief at the Toronto Star. And in the good news department, velvet-voiced homeless man gets second chance. Ex-radio announcer's life story goes viral, netting him praise and job offers. Ted Williams, a 53-year-old former radio announcer, is gone from living in a tent obscurity to being offered a job as an announcer for the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. The story began in December when Columbus Dispatch videographer Doral Chenoa III and his wife Robin were driving along a highway in their hometown. Mrs. Chenoa said her husband always stops near Interstate 71 and Hudson Street to speak to the homeless panhandlers. He'd photographed them for years, she said, and takes particular interest in their signs. Mr. Williams, a wild-haired man with a sunny disposition, was holding a piece of cardboard that said, "I have a God-given gift of voice. I'm an ex-radio announcer who has fallen on hard times." They rolled down the window to offer him money, and he launched into a radio spot. "When we heard him speak, we were just blown away because he had such a velvety voice," Mrs. Chenoa said. "When you first hear it, you're looking at a guy who's shaggy. His hair is wild. His clothes are unkempt. So you don't expect it." Chenoa didn't have his camera with him and returned several times trying to find Mr. Williams. Eventually, he was able to interview him on camera at the roadside. He posted the video to the Columbus Dispatch website on Tuesday, and by Wednesday morning, the story was all over the internet. Ms. Chenoa said page views jumped from 2.7 million to 4.1 million readers in the span of 10 minutes. Mr. Williams has spent what appears to be at least the last several months living in a tent in a homeless camp in Columbus. Mr. Williams told a local radio station, "I would just like a job in a home, an apartment, anything to cook in. In the blink of an eye, that dream is now within reach." And that story by Joe Friesen in the Globe and Mail. That's all the news we have in Disrespect this week. Come back next week. You know, there will be more. And to take us out, Lucy Kaplansky, "One Good Reason."
Woke up scared in the middle of the night. He reached reached for the bottle, turned on the light, looked at the clock, this can't be right. I'm not dreaming. Turned on the TV and the radio, Elvis rocked and Elvis rolled, and Jesus on his radio show said, pack your bags, we're leaving. There's a line I've crossed somewhere, I left the best of me back there. Never thought I'd end up here, 'cause all the best things disappear. Whiskey is his water and it's made in hell, from the bottom of his barrel to the bottom of his well. Nothing in this room but an empty shell, and he's not dreaming. A drunkard's regrets are a dime a dozen, a thousand cures and a thousand poisons. Even Elvis couldn't find one good reason to keep believing. There's a line I've crossed somewhere, I left the best of me back there. I never thought I'd end up here, 'cause all the best things disappear. Thought she had nothing to lose when she told him he had to choose. Nice idea, but they both knew that she'd be leaving. Well, Jesus said, seek and you shall find. He doesn't think it's true this time. Some things you look for, you never find. Like one good reason. There's a line I've crossed somewhere, I left the best of me back there. Never thought I'd end up here, 'cause all the best things disappear. Never thought I'd end up here, 'cause all the best things disappear.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.